You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Good morning. Here we are. We are at Christmas Confidential number 3. First, we did the Gospel according to Matthew, and we did the Gospel according to Luke, and now we're doing what, it's not really a nativity in John, but it kind of is, and it's one that I think is really important to embrace at this time of year. And just by way of review, let me just go over a couple things we've talked about already. Number one is nobody knows when Jesus was actually born. But symbolically, the end of December is a pretty good choice. It's the winter solstice. Now, I say that hesitatingly, because it's not winter in Australia. And my Australian friends watching this on live stream will get after me because it's the summer solstice for them, right? So this whole thing is very northern hemisphere-ish. They're kind of like irritated that we kind of claim all of the language. So I'm going to call it the December solstice, just to kind of keep that straight. They have a hard time of doing Christmas with the same kind of angle we do because it's wintry and it's the darkness becoming light and they're just the opposite, right? So that being said, our December solstice was Friday at 3:23 p.m., if you want to keep records of that. Karen Clausen and others were out in the Memorial Garden on Saturday morning, that was yesterday, and they were marking the solstice where the sunrise came up so that when we put our labyrinth back in after the building is completed, that we can realign our labyrinth with the rising of the sun on the December solstice. Now, why do we do something like that? Well, number one is we want to remind ourselves of our place in the larger and virtually incomprehensibly vast universe that we live in, right? It's a celestial phenomena which we are recognizing that we are an incredibly small and humble part of. And secondly, it connects us to the traditions of our ancestors that gave us the day on which we celebrate Jesus' birth. Does that make sense? I mean, this is an important day. Now, remember, just to put it in context, about the same time that Christianity was really gaining some momentum in Rome, Sol Invictus, the unconquered sun, was made the official sun god of the Roman Empire, okay? Now, this was in 274 of the Common Era. Emperor Aurelian made Sol Invictus an official cult alongside all the other official cults that there were, right? But this was called, now listen, and Nat, you're going to have to correct my Latin on this because I'm not going to be able to pronounce this correctly. Dies Natalis Solis Invicti. Right? In English, that's, see if this sounds familiar, the divine nativity of the unconquered sun. Right? Do you see him on the right there? Okay. So, does that sound familiar at all? Guess when the divine nativity of the unconquered sun is celebrated. On what day? December 25th. That's exactly right. Now, and I've always thought, okay, wait a second, the winter or December solstice and December 25th. Why, you know, how come the difference here? There's 3 days in there between the solstice and Christmas Eve. Well, if you look at it astronomically, and I'm no expert, so you can correct me, but the way I've read is that actually on the 21st is when the sun gets to its furthest place it's going to go. And then it kind of takes a few days to grind the gears and start going back the other direction. How many days? 3 days, right? And so actually the 25th is the day, the first day, that the day starts to actually get longer again. So you see the symbolism here, how cool that is? That, oh, thank God, the sun isn't going away forever. It's going to come back. So, all right, I share this with you, and, you know, why does it matter? Because I think it's important to put the gospel that we're about to hear in context. John was written sometime, you know, after 90 of the Common Era. And if you look at the development of the Jesus texts in chronological order, like we've been doing, you get Paul to start off. And what did he say about Jesus? He said, Jesus was born of a woman. He was just like us, right? And then you move down the line a little bit. Mark doesn't say anything about an extraordinary birth, just kind of lets it sit there that Jesus was a human being. And then Matthew, what does Matthew do? He ties the whole birth to this celestial magic event, right? The star that the wise men follow. So we start to get into kind of the cosmic nature of how important Jesus is. And then, and we'll just leave Luke aside right now, considering that that date of that gospel is kind of in reevaluation mode. It might be a lot later than we think. But we finally come to John. The gospel of John doesn't have a birth narrative per se. But Jesus was so important for that author that the traditional birth stories just, you know, the stuff that we share at Christmas just wasn't good enough. It didn't put Jesus in good enough light. Forget the wise men. Forget the star. Not good enough. Forget Herod and all the political intrigues. Not good enough. What you're going to hear in today's telling is that John places Jesus' birth, as it were, in the beginning. And more than that, Jesus is indispensable to creation itself. One with God, one with the evolving cosmos, and one with humanity. Wow. Okay? So you see how Jesus keeps getting, I keep talking about Jesus getting upgrades, right? So keeps getting upgraded as we go. And I want you to listen for what is essentially triumphant language that sets the foundation for the rest of John's telling of the story. You know, he's saying, look, folks, just in case you had any question about who we're dealing with in this story, remember, everything that is anything that ever was and ever is to be came into being because of Jesus. Got it? Right? Are you clear who we're dealing with? Okay, then. Let's listen to what John says about the beginnings of creation and Jesus' part in it.
In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through him, and without him not one thing came into being. What has come into being in him was life, and the life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Let's pray. Loving and gracious Spirit, we come grateful for these words of wisdom that come to us from the earliest generations of what it meant to be a follower of Jesus. And as we, with those followers, work through what it looks like in our lives to be companions with Jesus, may our hearts and minds be open to the Spirit's guidance, so that we might hear these words anew, and that none of us would leave this place unchanged. We gather as followers of Jesus. Amen. All right, I have to confess, as an ASU grad, thank you. I really hate to acknowledge anything that other school does. But I need to tell you, did you know that under the bleachers of that other school's stadium, University of Arizona, under the bleachers, scientists are helping to build the largest telescope in the world? Right? Okay, now, the telescope itself isn't under the bleachers. That would be weird. That'd be like James Bond, you know, where they go, and the telescope comes up. You know, it's not that what they're actually doing is they're manufacturing the mirrors for what is called the Giant Magellan Telescope that is going to be constructed in Chile. Now, the telescope is going to be using cutting-edge technology that utilizes many mirrors to reflect and focus the light from the cosmos into one place. And they've already completed a number of the 27-foot-wide mirrors. Here you can see the engineers, they're laying all these blocks of specialized glass into this form, and they've got this huge oven. Did I mention it's underneath the bleachers at that other school? So it's a hot seat, I guess, sometimes. But they raise the temperature to nearly 3,000 degrees, and all of those glass blocks melt into a gelatinous goo, and then they let it cool over many, many months. And then once that's cooled and hardened, then they begin the polishing process, and that takes many, many months to years. They've been working on this for years, and they're up to, I think, mirror 5 right now that they're working on presently. They're not going to be done with all of them. They're doing 7, and they're doing an 8th just for backup in case they drop one. And that will be done by the end of 2023. So, like I said, they're using 7 of these mirrors. They are not small, right? 7 of them. The Giant Magellan is designed to look further back in time than we've ever been able to see before. Now, you get that? I mean, stars that are 10,000 light years away, we're seeing light that left them 10,000 years ago, right? And what this is going to do is short-circuit that whole process. They're going to be able to look further back in time, like when the light before it gets to us, right? It's time travel. So it is amazing technology, and astronomers are going to be able to see far fainter objects, and they're going to be able to conduct more detailed observation of our nearby stars. And I'm excited about this, exoplanets, right? See if anybody's waving. All of this with a sharpness that is 10 times better than the Hubble Space Telescope. Now, you've seen the pictures from Hubble, right? I mean, that's extraordinary. So this is amazing. So why does this matter? Why am I even bringing up that other school? Well, it's called context, okay? That's how passionate I am about context. When John was written, conventional wisdom had that creation was not that so long ago. You know, maybe a few generations ago, right? We talk about young earthers now thinking that the earth is creation is 6,000 years old, right? Now, I'm not sure what the author of John thought about the distance of creation, but what I do know is that they knew it was a long time ago, and for sure, they wanted their boy to be taken seriously on a crowded stage of divinely born godmen. They had to claim something that was even more spectacular than some pedestrian virgin birth, which were a dime a dozen back then. You want to Google it? You can track that down. Now, they wanted to say, our guy didn't just have this plain old virgin birth. Our guy was present before creation itself. There wasn't anything that was made that wasn't directly made by our guy. That ought to do it, right? Try and beat that, right? That's the whole point of this opening. It's shock and awe. It says, look at who this guy is. Now, fast forward to our modern understanding of cosmology and telescopes like the one being worked on at that other school, and it has helped put the date of creation back to 13.7 billion years ago, give or take a fraction of a billion years or so. I can't even begin to comprehend that kind of number. And to think that our whole history, as much as we want to do, is maybe 4,000 years old, right? Even more than when John was first written, we need to embrace the opening of John as theological hyperbole. It's meant to, as I said before, upgrade Jesus in the pantheon of gods that are vying for our attention. And there's one more metaphor that John uses, and uses often, and that's light. Now, we forget that in our culture, in our age, we flip a switch, right? We change a light bulb. We have essentially domesticated darkness. But the radical contrast between light and darkness lurks in the primordial ooze of our brains, of our psyche. It does in mine. I don't know about yours. I know about this time of year, Laura and I will look at one another, and it's like, man, is it time? Oh, it's only 5 o'clock, you know, and it's dark out. Or, you know, we get up and we're on our way to work. It's still dark out. Oh, my gosh. And, you know, that kind of works on people. You know, thank God we don't live in Alaska. I don't know if I could make it. But during Advent, the sun begins to set earlier each day. It's almost imperceptible. I always get caught by surprise when it's so dark so early. And that helps us, I think, get in touch with that reality from ancient days. Primitive people saw this happening. They saw the sun dropping lower and lower on the horizon at this time of year. And to deal with it, they developed all these kinds of festivals to encourage the sun. You know, come on, sun, don't give up. You can do it. You can do it. And, you know, who are our favorite neighbors but the Mayans, right? They even went so far as to do human sacrifices to strengthen the sun as it traveled through the underworld. And they, like others, were afraid of being left in unremitting night. Somewhere in the depths of our unconsciousness, we share that primordial fear. And when there is the first indication that the days are going to lengthen, our hearts, our spirits lift. What a relief. The end has not come. And so a new year makes a new birth for us. Now, this time of year, we'll often hear readings in church from Isaiah, where the prophet encourages the people with a reminder that the people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Do you remember that part? Right? John picks up on that theme and proclaims, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it, right? So we have that theme happening. Light is one of those primal metaphors that makes our celebration at this time of year tick. I don't know. Did you put up Christmas lights? Anybody put it? Why? It's to push back the darkness. We light candles here. Every week we light another candle. Why? Because it's getting darker. So we need more candles, right? We're trying to push back the darkness because darkness has a reality that has an effect on us. Now, many years ago, Robert Fulghum, who is the author of, remember, Everything I Ever Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten, right? Also a Unitarian pastor. He noted that there's a question that often comes at the end of seminars or any kind of lectures or things like that. The facilitator or the teacher will ask, are there any questions? Right? And I don't know about you, but when that happens with me, I think, oh, no, please, God, don't let anybody ask a question. I'm tired. I want to go home. I've taken enough notes. But he will often ask a particular question. He waits for that. And a lot of people think that it's a joke question, but he takes every opportunity to ask it. And he says, if someone says, are there any questions? He answers with, what is the meaning of life? Right? Can you see yourself in that meeting? But Fulghum says, you never know, right? You never know. Somebody may have the answer. And I would hate to miss it because I was too socially inhibited to actually say it. So once and only once, he said that he asked that question and he got a serious answer, one that is with him still. The site where it happened is important. It was an institute for peace that was constructed in Crete, near the site of a small airstrip where Nazi paratroopers had landed and invaded Crete and were attacked by Cretan peasants with knives and pitchforks. And the retribution was terrible. The populations of whole villages were lined up and executed by the Nazi soldiers. The populations were seen as assaulting Hitler's finest troops with knives and pitchforks. And high above where this institution is built on the side of a cliff is the cemetery where those Cretan partisans were buried. And there's a big cross that is marking that cemetery. And if you go across the bay, on the other side of the bay, there's the cemetery where the Germans are buried. And that's marked by a German iron cross, so they can always be in sight of one another. The memorials are placed that way so that whichever one you were at, you would see the other, so that you would never forget. Because there was a time when hate was the only weapon that the Cretans had. And at the end, it was the only weapon that they vowed to never give up. Never, ever are we giving up hate. And so it was a perfect place for an institute that would promote peace and healing the wounds of war. And this institute was begun by a man named Alexander Papaderos. He was a doctor of philosophy. He was a teacher. He was a politician. And at war's end, he came to believe that the Germans and the Cretans had much more to give one another than either one of them thought. In fact, that they needed to be in relationship with one another. For if they could forgive each other and construct a creative relationship, then anybody could. That was the motivation behind this institute. And Papaderos succeeded in creating it. It became a reality, and this conference ground was the site of not only the horror of those battles and those executions, but it was also the site of amazingly productive interaction between the people of these two countries. Books have been written on the dreams that were realized from people that had met others at this place and worked together to find resolution, to find reconciliation, to find ways towards peace. Fulghum writes about that by the time he actually came to that institute for a summer session, Papaderos was a living legend. And, you know, he said you could just look at him and you could see he was one of those people that you meet and it was like almost electric humanity, you know. And he's one of the few people that he's ever met that didn't disappoint him. You know, when you meet one of your heroes, he just was more than he ever could have imagined. And at the end of the session, which was 2 weeks long, Papaderos went up to the front of the room, and here he was standing with the big windows looking out across the bay, across to where the Iron Cross was standing. And he stood there, and he was bathed in sunlight, and he asked the question, right? Are there any questions? And everybody kind of, no questions? He gave everybody a second chance, and everybody's like starting to pack up, right? And Fulghum raised his hand and said, Dr. Papaderos, what is the meaning of life? Laughter broke out, and people really started packing up their stuff. Papaderos stilled the room, and he looked at Fulghum in the eyes to see if he was serious. He saw that he was serious. And so he said, I'm going to answer your question. And he reached into his hip pocket and pulled out a wallet. And into that, he reached and pulled out a very small round mirror, about the size of a quarter. And what he said went like this. When I was a small child, during the war, we were very poor. And we lived in a remote village. One day on the road, I found the broken pieces of a mirror. A German motorcycle had crashed there. I tried to find all of the pieces of the mirror and put it back together, but it was impossible. So I kept only the largest piece, this one. And by scratching it on a stone, I was able to make it round. And I began to play with it as a toy and became fascinated by the way that I could reflect light into dark places where the sun would otherwise never shine, in deep holes and crevices and dark closets. It became a game for me to get light into the most inaccessible places that I could. He said, I kept that little mirror, and I went about my growing up. I'd take it out in idle moments and continue the challenge of the game. And as I became a man, I began to understand that this was not just a child's game, but it was a metaphor for what I might do with my life. I came to understand that I am not the light. I'm not the source of light. But light, be it truth or understanding or knowledge, is there, and it will only shine in dark places if I reflect it. He said, I am a fragment of a mirror whose whole design and shape I do not know. Nevertheless, with what I have, I can reflect light into the dark places of this world, into the darkest places of people's hearts, and maybe change some things in people and the world. Perhaps others may see and do likewise. This is what I'm all about. This is the meaning of my life. And Fulghum said he then took the mirror and held it carefully in the bright rays of the daylight streaming through the window and reflected them onto Fulghum's face and onto his hands folded on the desk. Fulghum said that much of what he had experienced in the way of, you know, information about Greek culture and history that summer is long gone from memory. But he said in the wallet of his mind, he still carries a small round mirror. A reminder, I think, of our stream of thought for today. A passage from Matthew. You are the light of the world. Do you remember that? We're not a source of that light. We reflect that light. And I hate to admit it, but the folks at that other school have got it right. One mirror is good, but more mirrors are better. They're settling for 7, right? I'm not settling for anything less than all of you. Every one of us, as Papaderis said, is a fragment of a mirror whose whole design and shape we do not know. But with what we have, we can reflect light into the dark places of the world. And I am convinced that we can change things. You hear me often mention tikkun olam, that Jewish phrase about healing the world. If you want to get right down to it, that phrase comes out of tradition in Judaism that harkens back to the idea that at the beginning of time, the beauty of creation that includes all of us was cracked and shattered into uncountable number of pieces. And that the phrase tikkun olam refers to our obligation, our responsibility to be on about taking that shard, that one shard, which is us, and bringing it back into place with others so that we can be a part of healing, of making, bringing back to the original situation that which began. Together, even as the darkness gathers, we have the gift to increase our reflective power exponentially. So, here's to the light that we can reflect individually and collectively, that the light of Christ might be known in even the darkest places. Amen.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information on our faith community or to support this outreach with a donation, be sure to visit us online at www.reachtouchteach.com.